Ekatra Podcast Conversations, for the curious essential knowledge simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Ekatra AI. Welcome to the deep dive. Today, well, we're putting on our intellectual detective hats.
Yeah, definitely.
And we're plunging into a book that really forces you to question pretty much everything you think you know about cause, effect, and, well, human motivation.
We're talking about Stephen Levitt and Stephen Dubner's Super Freakonomics.
Exactly. And it's, you know, it's less a straightforward book and maybe more like a toolkit.
Yeah, a toolkit for thinking differently, radically even. If you've come across their work before, you'll know their whole mission is kind of nudging you to become a freak.
A freak, meaning someone who basically ignores the conventional wisdom.
Right. Someone who demands the hard data instead of just accepting things.
And the central question they pose is just so compelling, isn't it?
It really is.
What does the data really tell us about how the world works once we ignore what people say and focus just on what they actually do?
Mm-hmm. It's all about peeling back those layers, you know, the emotion, the easy assumptions we all make.
And that relentless focus, it leads straight to their core idea. The premise we'll probably keep coming back to.
Which is that incentives, well, they're the cornerstone of modern life. They drive behavior.
Often in ways that are hidden or maybe counterintuitive?
Completely. Like, you might assume we spend resources fighting the biggest risks on the road, right?
Sure. Makes sense. Drunk driving, for instance.
But the data often points somewhere else.
Yeah.
Statistically, per mile traveled, a drunk walker is actually about 8 times more likely to be killed than a drunk driver.
Wow. 8 times. That's staggering.
Yeah. But we focus on the driver because, well, the driver is the villain in the story, not necessarily the biggest statistical danger.
Okay, that's instantly a really profound example of how, like, public perception and emotion can just derail rational thinking.
And resource allocation, too.
So how did they manage to apply this really ruthless, evidence-based economic lens to things like crime, parenting, even global warming? It seems like quite a leap.
Well, it took a pretty unique partnership to pull it off.
Ah, right. The authors themselves.
Exactly. On one side, you've got Stephen D. Levitt. He's the freak, you could say, the one with the super rigorous methodology.
Okay.
He's a distinguished professor of economics at the University of Chicago. And he won the John Bates Clark Medal.
Which is huge in economics, right? Like, yep, a precursor to the Nobel.
Pretty much, yeah. His whole thing is applying economic theory and stats, not to, you know, stocks and bonds, but to these really unconventional social problems.
Like figuring out why crime rates dropped, or wasn't there just think about sumo wrestlers cheating?
That's exactly the kind of stuff he digs into.
Okay, so you've got the hardcore data guy. Who's the other half?
That's Stephen J. Dubner. He's the master storyteller, an accomplished journalist, worked for the New York Times Magazine. His job is basically making sure all that dense academic research is translated into something, well, readable. Entertaining, even. He makes the data sing.
So that's the magic formula, then, the fusion of those two approaches.
I think so. Levitt brings the intellectual firepower, the, you know, the data-driven analysis. Dubner brings the narrative flair.
Making those complex, sometimes really shocking findings accessible.
Exactly. They bridge that gap between, like, dense academia and the general public. They actually make economics kind of fun.
So diving into the book's overall purpose.
Mm-hmm.
It seems pretty clear. They want to show that this economic way of thinking,
which is fundamentally about incentives, data, causation.
Right. That it's maybe the most powerful lens you can use to understand all human behavior, not just, you know, financial markets.
Yeah. They really operate like intellectual detectives. They walk us through these fascinating puzzles. Could be about prostitution or terrorism or even altruism.
And they keep this amoral perspective throughout.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Based purely on evidence.
Totally. It's crucial to get that they're never asking what's right or wrong. They're strictly asking, what does the data show is happening? Nothing else.
The sheer range of topics is what grabs you, though.
Yeah.
I mean, one minute they're analyzing sex work. The next, it's radical geoengineering for climate change.
Mm. And then human goodness, the bystander effect. Sounds kind of dizzying.
It does a bit.
But every chapter, it's all connected by that single economic mindset, that focus on incentives.
So what's the intended outcome for us, for the listener? What do they want us to take away?
I think it's pretty simple, really. They want to encourage skepticism towards, you know, the easy answers, the conventional wisdom.
And inspire you to think more rationally, maybe more creatively, about complex stuff.
Exactly. If you stop just accepting things and start asking, okay, but show me the data, then they've kind of succeeded.
All right, let's get into some specific findings then. Starting with, what happens when powerful new data clashes with what people already believe?
Yeah, the book opens with this really tragic but incredibly illustrative story. Dr. Ignaz Semmelweis, back in the 19th century.
The hand-washing guy.
That's him. The Semmelweis metaphor just perfectly captures how evidence gets resisted, you know.
So he proved, using stats, that simply washing hands dramatically cut deaths from childbed fever.
Compelling proof. But the medical establishment just rejected it. Why? Because it contradicted their own status and beliefs.
It was easier to ignore the data than accept that they, the respected doctors, were maybe the problem.
Sadly, yes. Easier than admitting they might be the carriers of death.
And that resistance to inconvenient data, it's still around today, right?
Yeah.
Especially when emotions get involved.
Oh, absolutely. We already touched on the drunk walking risk versus drunk driving.
Right. Are you saying that how we allocate resources for public safety is mostly driven by, like, who we decide is the villain?
In many cases, yeah, essentially. The drunk driver, clear villain, generates outrage, leads to big spending on laws and enforcement. The drunk walker, often seen as just, well, a fool, a victim of their own choices. So there's no outrage, no big policy push.
Even though statistically, that person is way more vulnerable mile for mile.
Exactly. It just shows how we allocate resources based on the story, the narrative, not always the statistical reality.
They also point out how we often chase these expensive, complex solutions when simple fixes get overlooked, like the car seat example.
Yeah, the finding that so many child car fatalities weren't due to faulty design, but just incorrectly installed seats.
A fix that just needs better education, better instructions, maybe. Not necessarily some costly new invention.
Right. Cheap, simple, but overlooked.
Okay, so that brings us to how incentive structure, even taboo markets. They dig into prostitution using data from Chicago.
They do. And it's basically an analysis of classic economic concepts, things like price discrimination and compensating differentials.
Okay, let's maybe break those terms down a bit. Price discrimination and compensating differentials.
Sure. So think about street prostitutes versus high-end escorts. The difference in pay is, well, astronomical.
Even though the core service might seem similar on the surface.
Right. And that's where these concepts fit in. Street prostitutes, they face really high risk, low pay, low barriers to entry. So high supply of low-skilled labor.
Got it.
High-end escorts. They earn massively more because they offer a specialized product that's the price discrimination part, and they often operate in a safer environment.
And the compensating differential.
That's the higher pay you get for taking on higher risk or doing more unpleasant or dangerous work. So part of the street prostitute's lower pay reflects the danger, but the high-end escort commands a premium for skill and safety.
And they use that department store Santa analogy to kind of prove the market logic.
Yeah, it's a great illustration. Being Santa, it doesn't require super high skill, right?
Right.
But the demand is intense and only for a very short time, November, December. So that temporary spike drives up wages for what's essentially low skill labor, classic supply and demand.
Okay, now here's where the analysis gets into some really extreme territory. The rationality of terrorists.
Yeah, this is definitely one of the more controversial bits. They challenge the idea that suicide bombers are just irrational fanatics.
How?
They view them as actors responding to specific, clear incentives. Things like martyrdom, glory, but also, crucially, financial rewards for their families from the organization.
Which led to that really bizarre puzzle about life insurance, didn't it?
It did. If you're committed to dying for a cause, why on earth would you buy life insurance? It seems completely illogical.
But the data showed.
Shockingly, that suspected terrorists were more likely to have life insurance than the average person.
How do they explain that?
The key idea is signaling. Buying insurance acts as a signal to the terrorist group.
Signaling what?
That the bomber is committed, reliable, plan-oriented. It helps ensure that the financial security promised to their family will actually materialize.
Wow. So it turns this seemingly selfless, maybe irrational act into a kind of strategic economic calculation.
Exactly. Which, interestingly, they suggest might even offer some practical detection angles for authorities looking for those signals.
Okay, let's pivot slightly to another really controversial and very relevant discussion, the economics of global warming.
Right. They don't really debate whether it's happening. That's not their focus.
What is their focus then?
It's whether the traditional solutions are, well, economically feasible or effective enough. They treat it purely as a cost-benefit problem.
So if the usual expensive methods, like curbing emissions, aren't working fast enough.
Then, they argue, we absolutely must consider radical alternatives, even if they're politically unpopular or seem strange.
And the most radical one they discuss is geoengineering, specifically something called the Stratoshield.
Yeah, the Stratoshield idea. It's audacious, no doubt, but the key is it's potentially cheap.
How would it work?
The idea is basically to mimic nature, specifically the cooling effect we see after huge volcanic eruptions like Mount Pinatubo back in the 90s. So they propose pumping sulfur dioxide or similar aerosols way up into the stratosphere. The goal is to reflect just a tiny fraction of the sun's energy back into space, cooling the planet.
It sounds, well, like a sci-fi movie. And very controversial.
Oh, definitely. Because it's a quick fix, right? It doesn't address the root cause, the CO2 emissions. But from a purely economic standpoint, its potential cost is drastically lower than global decarbonization.
So in their pragmatic view, it just has to be an option on the table based on cost and feasibility alone.
That's their argument, even if it makes people uncomfortable.
That really is classic Freakonomics thinking, isn't it? Finding that surprising, pragmatic, often very effective answer that conventional wisdom just rejects out of hand.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, let's maybe wrap up the specific examples of the economics of goodness. Altruism. They talk about the Kitty Genovese case.
Right, the famous case in New York. They confirm that while the media might have exaggerated parts of that specific story,
the underlying bystander effect is real.
Yes, statistically, it's a real phenomenon. People are genuinely less likely to help when lots of other people are present. Diffusion of responsibility.
And their lab findings on generosity? They say, well, maybe a bit humbling.
They are. When people play these economic games in labs, they often give money away, which seems altruistic. But the authors conclude it's usually not pure altruism. They call it warm glow altruism or impure altruism.
Warm glow altruism. What does that mean in practice? Like, how does that work?
It basically means we get a personal internal satisfaction, that warm glow, from the act of giving.
Oh, okay.
So the charitable act becomes a blend of self-interest and actual charity. We give because it makes us feel good or maybe look good socially.
Not necessarily because the recipient's well-being is our only driver.
Right. There's usually some element of self-benefit mixed in, even if it's just feeling good about ourselves.
Okay, so let's zoom out a bit. Let's try and pull together the key themes that connect all these really diverse topics. Theme one seems obvious.
Incentives are the cornerstone of modern life. That's the bedrock, right?
Absolutely. And the practical takeaway there is, if you want to change behavior your own, and employees, a public outcome,
you have to look at the incentive structure, financial, social, moral, whatever it is. Don't just rely on willpower or what people say they'll do.
Because the behavior you actually see is the behavior the system is currently incentivizing.
Precisely.
Okay, theme two. This feels like the mandate for skepticism.
Yeah. Conventional wisdom is often a poor guide to reality.
We have to demand evidence over just assuming things are true. Like questioning the focus on the drunk driver or the data points somewhere else.
Mm-hmm. Theme three is about thinking about problems at scale and cost effectiveness.
We tend to misallocate resources based on emotion or outrage.
We do. The book really pushes for a pragmatic cost-benefit analysis. Think about the scale of the problem, the cost of the solution, regardless of how emotionally appealing complex fixes might seem.
And theme four is that distinction we talked about earlier, the amoral versus the immoral analysis.
Right. They study really sensitive topics without passing moral judgment, simply to find what actually works.
Arguing that moral outrage, however justified it feels, can actually blind us to the root causes of a problem.
Making it impossible to solve effectively. You have to be willing to look at it objectively first.
The book is just packed with memorable lines that kind of distill this worldview, isn't it?
Oh, definitely. So many quotes stick with you.
Like the foundational one. Incentives are the cornerstone of modern life. Simple, elegant, explains everything they look at.
And the sort of mandate for the reader. The conventional wisdom is often wrong, and even when it's right, it's not very useful. It really forces you to question things.
I like the one that expands the definition of their field. Economics is not about money. It's about how people make choices.
Yeah, that explains why they can study, you know, the price of sex one minute and the cost of saving the world the next using the exact same lens.
And finally, that plea for objectivity. Solving a problem is hard enough. It's even harder if you're not willing to look at it in the first place.
You just have to set your biases aside, even for a moment, to see clearly.
So how do we actually apply all this? in our own lives?
Well, for personal decision-making, the book's lens is just invaluable, I think.
How so?
It encourages you to evaluate risks based on actual data, not just fear or, you know, scary headlines.
Like the drunk walking lesson. The next time you're walking home after a night out, you might think a bit differently about where the real danger lies.
Exactly. And for policy or strategy, use the book to analyze proposals. Ask two simple questions.
Okay, what are they?
One, does this solution actually match the scale of the problem? And two, what are the likely unintended consequences?
Like the geoengineering discussion. It highlights that really complex problems sometimes need radical, cost-effective ideas that you only see if you remove the political noise.
Mm-hmm. And in the workplace. You can use the lessons from warm glow altruism and signaling
to question standard best practices.
Yeah. Maybe design incentive systems that account for social factors, intrinsic rewards, that warm glow. Not just straight financial bonuses. You might get better results.
Okay, final takeaways. What was the most surprising thing or your favorite element from the book?
For me, it has to be that epilogue about the capuchin monkey experiments. Just fascinating.
Where the economist taught monkeys how to use money.
Yeah, expecting just, you know, basic buying and selling.
And what actually happened?
They almost immediately started showing classic human economic biases. Things like loss aversion. They started stealing.
Wait, even prostitution-like exchanges. Among monkeys.
Apparently so. Trading tokens for grooming or even sex. It's kind of humbling, isn't it?
It really is. It suggests that maybe many of our cognitive biases, our economic instincts, aren't learned but are just deeply ingrained.
Yeah.
Primate stuff.
That takes us right back to our ancestors.
So the ultimate message from Super Freakonomics is what? That the world is more knowable.
I think so. More knowable and more logical than it often appears. Once you start spotting the hidden incentives driving things,
you gain clarity, power as a decision maker.
Exactly. Intellectual curiosity becomes this kind of superpower, and data is your guide to finding what's really going on.
So adopt the Freakonomics mindset. Challenge conventional wisdom everywhere. That seems like a pretty good takeaway.
Definitely worth the deep dive.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Ekatra Foundation.